Ever wondered if something you learned as, a fundamental truth, something almost universally accepted, might actually have some deep structural flaws?
It happens more often than you'd think.
Well, today we're taking a deep dive into precisely that kind of foundational idea, the ISLM model. For many of you, this might ring a bell from an economics class, maybe.
Oh, almost certainly.
Or you've heard economists casually toss it around. It's truly a global phenomenon taught in undergraduate macroeconomics textbooks everywhere as the go-to framework for understanding how economies work.
And, for good reason, back in its day, the ISLM model, which John Hicks first put together in 1937, is a really elegant simplification of Keynes' general theory.
Okay, so like a map.
Exactly. Think of it as a map. It shows us how two crucial parts of the economy, the market for goods and services, that's the IS curve, and the money market, the LM curve, how they interact. Where those two lines cross, that's supposed to be the economy's equilibrium.
The sweet spot for national income and interest rates.
That's the idea. And it's often used for what economists call comparative statics, basically taking a before and after picture when something big changes, like a policy shift.
And the big appeal, the promise really of this model is that it suggests policymakers can practically fine-tune the economy. They can shift these IS or LM curves using tools like, say, government spending, that's fiscal policy, or maybe adjusting the money supply monetary policy,
Supposedly.
supposedly guiding us towards stability and prosperity. But what if this nearly century-old foundation has some pretty serious cracks?
What if the map isn't quite right?
Exactly. What if it's been built on assumptions that just don't hold up in the real world?
That is the electrifying question, really, at the heart of the research we're exploring today. It's a fundamental challenge to how we've understood macroeconomics for, well, decades.
So our mission today is to unpack a really thought-provoking working paper. It's from 2022 by Yoki Yamaguchi and Kaoru Yamaguchi, called The Endogenous Money ISLM Model of the Debt Money System, Part 1.
And it's not just suggesting a little tweak here or there.
No, not at all. This paper says the very bedrock assumptions need a serious re-examination. They're proposing what they call a paradigm shift in how we think about the economy.
Right. They argue that the standard ISLM model, which, as you said, builds on two key assumptions, exogenous money and fixed prices, well, it might be leading us astray.
Okay, let's break those down. Exogenous money.
That means the money supply is seen as something external, something the central bank just decides on and controls completely, like turning a tap on or off.
And fixed prices. Pretty self-explanatory, I guess. Prices don't change in the model.
Exactly. But the Yamaguchis argue that in our modern system, fractional reserve banking, where banks lend out most deposits, most money is actually created endogenously. It sort of springs into existence from within the system, largely through the total amount of debt issued by private banks.
Okay, endogenous versus exogenous money. That sounds like a pretty fundamental difference.
It is. It changes everything.
So, to really dig into this, let's turn to, well, one of the biggest economic puzzles ever, the Great Depression of the 1930s.
The ultimate stress test for any economic model.
Absolutely. It was a period of just unprecedented turmoil, and it's a test case that economists like Greg Mankiw, whose textbook is, a staple in macro courses, use the ISLM model extensively to try and dissect.
Right. Mankiw, looking through that standard ISLM lens, mainly considered two big theories for what caused the depression. First, there was the spending hypothesis.
That's Keynes,
That's Keynes' idea, yeah. Blaming a collapse in overall demand investment, consumption, just cratering. In the model, that's the IS curve shifting sharply left.
Okay, and the result of that shift.
A big fall in income, and crucially, a drop in interest rates, too.
Okay, theory one. What was the other?
The other was the money hypothesis, famously pushed by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, though it has roots in Irving Fisher's earlier work.
And their culprit.
A severe contraction of the money supply. If the money supply shrinks, the LM curve, representing the money market, shifts left.
Which also leads to lower income.
Definitely lower income. But here's the key difference. It predicts higher interest rates because money becomes scarcer.
Okay, so two theories, two different predictions about interest rates. Spending says down, money says up.
Precisely. Now here's where the plot thickens. Mankiw looked at the actual historical data.
What did he find?
Well, he found himself having to reject the money hypothesis.
Really?
Why? Two main reasons. First, nominal interest rates during the Depression didn't rise. They actually fell pretty much continuously from 1929 to 1933.
The opposite of what the money hypothesis predicted.
Exactly. Second, real money balances, that's the money supply adjusted for price changes, actually rose initially between 29 and 31.
But a shrinking money supply, a leftward LM shift, should mean real balances fall, shouldn't it?
It absolutely should, according to the standard model. So Mankey concluded the traditional hypothesis just couldn't explain that initial devastating downturn.
Wow. So even with this massive foundational economic crisis, the main explanations using the standard textbook model just couldn't quite make all the pieces fit. That's a pretty big problem, isn't it?
It is a huge one. And this is precisely where the Yamaguchi and Yamaguchi paper really comes alive. They ran dynamic simulations of this standard ISLM model, they call it case one, and basically confirmed Mankey's struggle.
So their simulations showed the same inconsistencies.
Yes. Both the spending and the money hypotheses, under those standard assumptions of fixed prices and exogenous money, they failed to fully replicate the Great Depression's actual data.
What specifically couldn't they explain?
Well, the model couldn't handle falling prices happening at the same time as real money balances were rising. That was a big one. And it couldn't explain how real interest rates behaved either.
Real rates, not nominal.
Right, real rates. Surprisingly, they actually jumped initially during the Depression. This flatly contradicted the money hypothesis's prediction about rising nominal rates.
So the standard model fails on multiple counts.
It really struggles. And it raises that critical question. If our main economic map can't accurately guide us through a landmark event like the Depression, how reliable is it for navigating today's, you know, complex economy?
That's a profound challenge. It really suggests we might need a better map, or at least understand the limitations of the old one. Mankiw himself saw some issues, didn't he? He tried to extend the model.
He did. He recognized some of the problems and tried to refine ISLM by introducing expected inflation. The idea was to distinguish between real and nominal interest rates more clearly.
Why? What was he trying to show?
He wanted to explain how deflation falling prices could depress income, especially under the spending hypothesis, without needing the money hypothesis's awkward prediction about rising nominal rates.
So trying to salvage the spending hypothesis explanation.
In a way, yes, but the Yamaguchi and Yamaguchi paper points out some, well, pretty crucial issues with Mankiw's extended version too.
Oh, like what?
For one, it still mostly treated prices as fixed, even while discussing expected deflation. That's logically inconsistent.
Yeah, you can't really assume prices are fixed if you're talking about them falling.
Exactly. And there were some technical issues, too, sort of unit inconsistencies in the math, making it unreliable. So to fix this, the Yamaguchis developed their own case two dynamic model.
Okay, what's different in case two?
They incorporated flexible prices, prices that actually change based on things like inventory levels and adaptive expectations for inflation. Much more dynamic, much more realistic.
But still assuming exogenous money.
Yes.
Yeah.
Case two still keeps the exogenous money assumption for now. Flexible prices, exogenous money.
Okay, so with these more realistic price dynamics, what did their case two model show about the Depression? Did it help?
It did, somewhat. The spending hypothesis within this flexible price model actually did a much better job. It successfully captured that fall in nominal interest rates and the initial critical rise in real interest rates.
The things the standard model struggled with.
Precisely. So it sort of validated Mankiw's idea that expected deflation mattered, even if his specific model had flaws.
But I sense a but coming.
There's always a but. The critical piece was still missing. Case two still couldn't explain the massive contraction of the money supply itself that happened during the Depression.
Ah, because money was still assumed to be exogenous, controlled from outside.
Exactly. The model couldn't generate that internal collapse of money. And the money hypothesis in case two, while it could explain the money contraction and deflation, still wrongly predicted rising nominal interest rates. So we're closer, but still haven't nailed it.
Okay, so after all these attempts, standard model, Mankiw's extension, case two with flexible prices, what's the fundamental truth that's emerging here? Where's the real problem?
The paper argues very forcefully that the core problem lies in that deeply ingrained assumption that the money stock is exogenously given, controlled by the central bank alone.
Like assuming the conductor controls every single note perfectly.
Yeah, or maybe assuming the amount of water in a complex plumbing system is solely determined by the main tap, ignoring all the internal leaks, flows, and storage tanks. Empirical studies, they point out, consistently show most money today is created endogenously by bank loans. It's what they call debt money.
Debt money. And this isn't a new idea, is it? You mentioned Irving Fisher before.
Exactly. This brings us back to Irving Fisher, a contemporary of Keynes, but often overshadowed. Back in 1933, Fisher proposed his debt deflation theory of Great Depressions.
Debt deflation. What was his chain of logic?
He saw this chilling sequence. First, you get over-indebtedness, too much borrowing. Then comes a wave of debt liquidation, people desperately trying to pay off debts.
Okay.
This forced liquidation causes a sharp contraction of deposit currency. That's the money created by banks when they make loans. It just
So
vanishes.
the money supply shrinks internally.
Right. And that contraction leads to falling prices, deflation. But here's the cruel twist. Deflation increases the real burden of any remaining debt. What you owe becomes harder to pay back.
Ouch, a vicious cycle.
Totally. This crushing debt burden then kills profits, forces businesses to cut output and jobs, which fuels pessimism. People start hoarding cash, and you end up with falling nominal interest rates, but critically, a rise in real interest rates.
That sounds remarkably like what actually happened in the depression data.
It really does. Now, what's absolutely fascinating, as you hinted, is Fisher's own journey. Initially, he advocated for a reflation policy, basically, printing more money to counteract the deflation.
Seems logical based on his theory.
You'd think. But then, in 1933, he received a copy of the Chicago Plan for Banking Reform. And after reading it, he actually abandoned his own reflation theory.
Wait, what? He changed his mind completely based on the Chicago plan.
It was a huge pivot, a monumental realization for him. He saw, maybe for the first time clearly, that the money stock was not an exogenous policy variable that the central bank could just easily pump up.
He realized the banks creating money internally was the key issue.
Exactly. He recognized that bank loans create deposits directly, and that the whole textbook money multiplier idea, where central bank money gets multiplied by banks, was unstable and basically uncontrollable by the Fed, especially during a crisis.
So the multiplier breaks down.
It did. He looked at the data. During the Depression, people held more physical cash, sure, but demand deposits the money in checking accounts created by banks fell by a staggering $8 billion between 1929 and 1933, a massive destruction of money stock from within the banking system.
Wow. So his solution wasn't reflation anymore.
No. This revelation led him to propose his 100% money theory, requiring banks to hold 100% reserves against deposits. Basically, stop private banks from creating and destroying money through lending.
A fundamental redesign of banking. And Keynes knew about this.
He did. Keynes was aware of the Chicago Plan, aware of Fisher's arguments about endogenous money, but ultimately he chose not to incorporate it into his general theory. He seemed to believe the money stock could be managed by other means, perhaps interest rate policy.
And that decision, well, it seems to have shaped macroeconomics for the next 80 plus years, sticking with the exogenous money view.
It really has. And this is where Yamaguchi and Yamaguchi step back in. They're trying to, in a sense, finish Fisher's work and bridge that gap. They propose what they call the endogenous money spending hypothesis.
Okay, combining Keynes and Fisher.
Precisely. It integrates Keynes's focus on aggregate demand changes, the spending part, with Fisher's crucial insight about endogenous money creation and debt dynamics.
So, how does this combined approach finally solve the puzzle? How does it explain the depression?
It describes this powerful positive feedback loop. Think about it in a downturn. First, A, aggregate demand falls, maybe investment sentiment sours, whatever the initial trigger.
Economy takes a hit.
Right. This leads to B, less demand for new loans, and crucially, forced repayment of existing debts.
Yeah.
Maybe banks call in loans, people default, a credit crunch.
Okay.
This debt liquidation then directly causes C, the endogenously created money stock itself, to contract. Less debt means less bank deposit money. That leads to deflation.
Falling prices.
And the deflation makes the real burden of all remaining debts heavier, and it pushes real interest rates up, even if nominal rates are falling.
Making things even worse.
Exactly. That feeds back to depress aggregate demand even more, leading to more loan defaults, more money destruction. It becomes this self-reinforcing downward spiral. Money isn't just passively responding, it's actively driving the crisis deeper.
That sounds much more plausible, much more dynamic.
It connects the dots in a way the other models didn't.
And the paper's case four model, this must be the one with flexible prices and the endogenous money.
That's the one, the culmination. They simulate this endogenous money spending hypothesis and the results.
Did it finally match the historical data checklist?
It nailed it. This revised model successfully captured all the key behaviors: the contraction of money stock for the right internal reasons, the deflation, The fall in nominal interest rates, the crucial rise in real interest rates, and even that puzzling initial rise in real money balances.
Wow, so it provides a consistent story where the others had missing pieces or contradictions.
Exactly. It offers a unified explanation. It seems to be the missing piece that makes the whole puzzle of the Great Depression finally fit together coherently within an ISLM-style framework, albeit a heavily modified one.
So this really isn't just a minor tweak, is it? They call it a paradigm shift.
Hmm.
What are the broader implications? Why should you, our listener, really care about this, you know, seemingly academic debate?
It's huge. It means we need to fundamentally shift our thinking from assuming money is exogenous, controlled from outside, to recognizing it's mostly endogenous, created inside the system by debt.
And from static snapshots
to dynamic system analysis, right. Understanding the feedback loops over time.
Yeah.
And crucially for policy, we can't just think about shifting IS or LM anymore. We have to understand the joint shifts, how they're intertwined through debt and money creation.
And does this have relevance beyond just understanding history, like for today?
Absolutely. Think about Japan's lost decades, right? Since the 90s.
Yeah, stagnant growth despite huge government spending and QE.
Exactly. Massive fiscal spending, tons of quantitative easing by the Bank of Japan, yet growth stayed flat and government debt ballooned. The traditional ISLM model, with its standard fiscal multiplier, predicted a much bigger boost from all that spending.
But it didn't happen.
It didn't. The endogenous money framework helps explain why. It suggests traditional monetary policy, like QE, might be ineffective because the central bank doesn't directly control the bulk of the money stock created by private banks.
They can flood reserves, but if banks aren't lending,
new money isn't created where it counts. And it helps explain why fiscal multipliers might seem weak or fail. The internal dynamics of the debt money system itself might be counteracting the intended stimulus effects.
So the plumbing itself is kind of clogged or working against the policy.
That's a good way to put it. Now, the Yamaguchis admit their revised model still faces challenges explaining the full severity and persistence of Japan's situation. That's apparently for part two of their research.
Something to look forward to.
Indeed. But even Partney undeniably highlights a fundamental flaw, a deep confusion in the standard textbook understanding of macroeconomics that's dominated for nearly a century. It's like finding a critical bug in the operating system of our economic thought.
Okay, so let's recap. We've taken a really deep dive today, peeling back layers of assumptions in basic macroeconomics. The big aha moment here, maybe for you listening, is realizing that the way money is actually created in our economy, mostly through debt issued by private banks, not just a government printing press, well, that reality has been largely ignored or seriously oversimplified in the models we all learn.
Right. And this Yamaguchi and Yamaguchi paper makes a really compelling case that embracing this endogenous money perspective, an idea Irving Fisher glimpsed almost 100 years ago, lets us build models that actually mirror economic reality much better.
Models that can explain huge events like the Great Depression far more effectively than the old standard ISLM.
Far, far better. It provides that coherent narrative that was missing.
Which really suggests that macroeconomic textbooks, you know, like Mankiw's ubiquitous one, are due for a pretty serious update, wouldn't you say?
Oh, definitely. They need to move beyond these confusing, often contradictory explanations of money, banking, and their effects. This old paradigm, exogenous money, fixed prices, comparative statics, it's had a long run.
Nearly a century.
But as we've seen, it really struggles to explain how the economy actually behaves, both in major crises and perhaps even in periods like Japan's long stagnation.
So the future of macro, if it wants to avoid what the authors call century-old confusion,
it really has to incorporate this dynamic endogenous money analysis. It's about getting the fundamentals right to understand stability, instability, and the actual effects of policy.
It's about understanding not just what happens, but why it happens and how the system's internal mechanics matter. Okay, so here's a final thought to leave you with. If a model as foundational, as widely taught as ISLM, needs this kind of radical rethink based on questioning its core assumptions about money, what other basic economic assumptions, or maybe assumptions in other fields entirely, might be overdue for their own deep dive review?
That's the big question, isn't it? It really challenges all of us to keep thinking critically, to question those givens, and to always be open to different perspectives, even on things we think are completely settled. Food for thought.